Hey, freedom seeker. Let's face it, entrepreneurship takes a heavy toll on our minds and bodies. If we aren't careful, we can end up down and out before we even reach our goals. When I interviewed Carl Pradelli, the founder of Nature City, I knew I wanted to share his brand with you. Carl is meticulous about sourcing honest, quality ingredients. Unlike many big name supplement companies that cut corners to save costs, Nature City has never wavered from offering the highest quality possible. You need to take care of your body if you want to keep your business running, right? So head over to naturecity.com/freedom to see their full lineup of supplements. And while you're there, check out TrueMind. What I love about TrueMind is that it promotes sustained mental energy for up to 5 hours without a crash. It's exactly what you need to stay productive without the jitters. Keep your wits about you, friend. Keep your mind sharp. Go to naturecity.com/freedom and get 15% off your order today. That's naturecity.com/freedom.
Hey, Freedom Seeker, welcome back to the Freedom Entrepreneur Podcast. I'm your host and business mentor, Lindsay Sutherland, and joining me today is Paul Poteet, who's the founder of Surge Investment Group out of Utah. And we're going to talk today about the power of finding secondary markets. Now, why is this relevant to you? I'm going to let Paul introduce himself here in just a moment. But dear listener, I always want to tell you what you want to stick around for. And sometimes, you know, what's interesting in marketing, they often say you want to find an ancillary vein, right? Something sort of just offshoot to what you think you're trying to go for. And that's kind of the secret here in the sauce that we're talking about today. So Paul's going to explain a little bit more about that. So welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to this show on whatever podcast player you prefer and follow me on Facebook and Instagram.
Thank you for having me, Lindsay. I'm excited to have this discussion today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I always look for creative entrepreneurs who have found a way. They're my favorite. They're favorite ones. Can you just kick it off a little bit? Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you come into this space? And, just share a little bit about who you are.
Yeah, absolutely. So Surge Investment Group is my company. We're a multifamily developer. We currently own about 400 units, which we built, have several other development projects in the works. But I started right out of college. I studied entrepreneurship. I knew I wanted to own a business. I had no clue what that business was going to be. And just by networking with friends that were successful entrepreneurs, I got introduced to someone who eventually became a mentor for me and a business partner. And was able to learn kind of under him, but with him for many years, just the circumstances lined up where I was able to be an owner and he needed my good credit score, untarnished credit score at the time. So I benefited greatly from that. We built that business together. And then eventually I sold my ownership there and started Surge. So that's a very condensed version of my background. If you want to dive into detail, I'm happy to do that. But I've been very blessed to get where I am right now.
Yeah. What kind of, tell us a little bit about how you found the mentor. I think that's something that I hear from truly a lot of very successful entrepreneurs. And I think there's a lot of people out there who, of course, coaching is so popular, right? So everybody just kind of thinks, I got to fall into this lane of getting a coach. But a mentor, I think, is a different It's just a different type of leadership. It's a different type of relationship. And I'm just curious, for the listening audience, do you have any advice for how people can maybe connect with a mentor?
I think that's a really good question. I'm going to try and do the answer justice. But I think with most things in life, if your sole purpose is to seek for something, sometimes it can be elusive and hard to find. But if you know kind of in the back of your mind that what you want as far as long-term goals, then eventually you'll be led to what you need. And so I call this hard-earned luck. And I knew that I wanted to do something with my life. I knew that I wanted to run a business. I was still trying to discover what that would be. And so I was just talking with people that I knew had achieved to some degree the success that I wanted. And then having those conversations, I was meeting with my best friend's father-in-law, who has a successful business in Utah County, Utah. And just, I mentioned the word real estate. I didn't know what that meant. To me, real estate was buying a house and renting it out. That's all I had ever learned about real estate. And it just so happened that he had talked with Mike, the guy that I ended up being partners with, a couple weeks prior to that conversation. So that was fresh in his mind. He then said, "Hey, I think you should meet this guy." I went to some educational courses that guy hosted, and I just got involved. I started learning. I asked him a lot of questions, and eventually he saw my ambition, some of my skill set, how that could benefit him, and he invited me to come into his business. And so it's not because I was searching for a mentor, it's because I was searching to learn, and to learn from whatever sources I could. And eventually things lined up where I found what I needed, even though maybe I didn't know that I needed it. You know, when he first offered for me to be an employee and to come work with him, I wasn't interested. I was like, "No, I'm gonna have my own business. Why would I work for somebody else?" So I told him no, but I continued to ask him questions and just ask for advice. And then eventually we worked out something where I came in and was an employee, but I also got a percentage of the profits that I brought in. So it was kind of a middle ground there. I don't know if that answers your question,
It
but.
does. Well, I'm also coming from the place that I've talked to a lot of, high-level entrepreneurs that have described very similar situations, and I see a through line. So, just for the listening audience, I'll elaborate because it's something I see as a, it's kind of like I sometimes feel like Napoleon Hill, where I get to interview, entrepreneurs who've been successful, and I see these, I guess you'd say a through line, something that consistently is happening in their life. And this word ambition comes up, just this general curiosity, this ambition, this drive. It doesn't always have a clear path forward yet, but it's just kind of like that knowing, that passion, it leads you right down this path. And often there's usually a, we'll say senior advisor, so to speak, somebody who's in that role who sees that ambition and chooses to nurture it. But it took that person showing up. It took that person being willing to ask questions and be vulnerable and show that they were willing to learn despite, maybe not knowing everything yet. And I think that's the thing that holds people a lot up is just that we get caught up in our own head. It's funny, Paul. I was just talking to my son. This conversation's reminding me of him. He's 13 and he's in 8th grade. So he wants to do this, he's got to do this shadow thing, right? And the school wants him to shadow a regular W-2 job, but he wants to be a real estate investor. And I said to him, I said, well, I know a lot of real estate investors. I'm sure I can connect you with somebody who's willing to let you shadow. And it worked out. We found a guy down in, because it has to be local. So he found somebody local. And of course, he was so generous. He's like, "Bring him down to this meetup. We'll highlight him." All the guy's name is Trevor. He said, "All of the old timers love it when we get new people in the room, especially kids that are interested. They love to just kind of nurture them." And it's easier, of course, when you're a young person because you have no preconceived notions, right? We're just innocent and showing up. But my son specifically said, "What would I do?" Because I told him, I said, I want you to ask questions. Don't be shy. Like, talk to people. Be willing to get their phone number. Like, show interest and ambition. I've seen enough of this conversation to be able to take. But he said that exact thing. But how do I do that? How do I show that ambition? Like, what does that look like? He doesn't want to intrude on them, right? That's where we hold ourselves back. So I just think it's so interesting. It's just a really interesting point of a conversation in it. I think it's a valuable one because really, there comes a time, and I'm sure you understand, like there comes a time in life where it's no longer just about the money. It's about the impact. It's about the giving back. It's about nurturing the next level of people. And you were gracious. You luckily found that kind of human who was willing to nurture you in that time.
Absolutely. Yeah, I just piggyback with what you're saying. I think we do hold ourselves back in a lot of ways. I think life does that to us naturally. But I've noticed I'm still young. I'm 32, about to turn 33 here in a month. And but I can also look back over the last 10 years in my journey. And if I were to put myself today in that same position, I don't know that I would have had that same opportunity just because I would have been more cautious, right? And so there's something to be said. Obviously, anybody can be successful and to go do something at any age, but there's something to be said about having that young ambition If any of your listeners are younger, that's the time to really just go for it. You have nothing to lose.
True, 100%. So when you got started, you launched your company. What were some of the challenges that you ran across, maybe and overcame, right? Because you're still kicking and you're still going. We all have challenges.
I don't think overcame is the right word. I think overcoming is probably the more appropriate word. But that's the thing. Everybody, you read books, biographies, you talk to entrepreneurs, everybody's going to say the same thing. And that is, it's really, really hard. The path of an entrepreneur is not for everybody. But when you're a young, ambitious, wannabe entrepreneur, that's like one of those things that goes in one ear and out the other. You don't like, yeah, okay, I understand it's hard, but you can't fully understand what that means until you live through it. And then you start living through it, you're like, oh, like this is what everybody means. It actually is really hard. I've had many times where I've felt like, is this right for me? Is this do I actually want to be doing this? Should I go get a job? I don't know. And I've had opposite times where everything's going incredibly well, and I know that this is my calling in life. And those ups and downs, it's just part of the journey. And I think that as an entrepreneur, the success doesn't come because you're having success all the time. Success comes because you're willing to endure, and you're willing to stick it out even when things don't seem like they're going well. So I know I answered your question generally there, but I think it's a very real thing that people need to understand too, is you could have the greatest idea in the world, but things are still going to get hard at some point. And if you're not prepared for that and willing to stick through the hard times, you're probably going to fail. But you can have a mediocre idea. Obviously, there has to be some sort of customer and value, but if you're able to execute well and just endure through the hard times, pivot, pivot, pivot until you find the right place to be, well, those are the people more times than not that end up being successful, even if their path to success looks wildly different from when they first set out on their journey. So I've definitely seen that in my path over the last couple of years. Hasn't been the easiest time for real estate. I've had to really to put in a lot of work to hold on to my assets. And to make sure that the financing in particular doesn't put us under, given that we did a lot of deals that were on the higher end of the leverage scale. But luckily we've had enough to be able to get what we needed to done to survive.
Yeah, it definitely goes in waves in real estate. I mean, all business does, but for sure it's more obvious in real estate, I think. It seems like a very, I don't know, you can almost like tell the path of the economy me based on the real estate market. So how does that let's little bit divest into strategy? I mean, how did that work for you as far as I have two questions specifically for you as a real estate entrepreneur. Number one is, how do you do it virtually or remotely? I mean, a lot of people are hearing about this online real estate investing, and you see a lot of these guys out there saying like, oh, it's so easy. I do it all from, I see this ad that pops up all the time, how he flips land from his laptop, and it just looks like, oh, this is such a cake job. And we all know there's real truth behind there's an actual truth behind that that's not being revealed in the ad. So curious how that kind of works for you. And then if you can lean into, your strategy to doing ancillary markets and kind of elaborate on that.
I think these are both things that I've arrived to over time. It's not necessarily how we start out. I lived up in the Salt Lake area when I started in real estate, and we were doing deals primarily in the Salt Lake area. And so for me, it was local, and that's how we were. Now, at some point, we went through COVID, and that changed how business was done. And I think being a younger guy like myself, I wasn't set in kind of the old ways of how things have always been done. And so it's easy for me to adopt a new way of doing things. So let me explain what I mean by that. For example, as a developer, if you buy a property, you're going to more often than not have to take that property through a city approval process, which includes going to meetings with staff, planning commission, city council, all those things. You have to be there in person. And so, at least before COVID, you did. And so it becomes really hard if I'm living in Utah and I'm doing a deal in Maine, for example, which I haven't done, but just use that as an example. That becomes really complicated every time I have to go to a city meeting, and a staff meeting to fly out to Maine and be there in person. Well, when COVID hit, everything became streamlined online. So I was able now to meet with city staff and with do planning commissions and city council meetings and all these things just through Zoom. And since COVID, a lot of that same process that these cities had implemented has stayed. And so that created an opportunity for me to do a lot more remote without having to travel. That's not to say that I never have to travel to see my sites, and it's not good practice to do so because it is. But the overall burden of travel has significantly been reduced through technology and how that's evolved. And then in this business, you have a lot of old faces that tend to be the real estate developers. You see them every now and then, but it's rare to see a young face like mine who's at a high level doing this business. And so I think that's given me an edge where I'm a little bit more comfortable with this idea of investing in and managing things remotely to be able to do what we do. So the next question you wanted to go into was more our market approach, how we
Well,
serve.
yeah, and because I mean, it kind of ties together. As my understanding is, you live in Utah, but you primarily invest maybe in the Texas area. And so, or, you know, that was one area we discussed. I'm sure you have multiple areas, but, you know, you had mentioned to me early on that, you know, maybe you don't invest necessarily in Dallas specifically, but you look for outside areas. And I think as a business strategy in general, though, this is very effective because. And I'll let you explain your strategy and how it relates in real estate because I think I can take it and turn it more into an online approach as well to just general business. It's a strategy that works in a lot of cases.
Sure. So let's use where I live, for example. I live in Utah, but I live in St. George, Utah, which for those unfamiliar with it is a town about 150,000 people. It's at the very, literally my neighborhood here is on the Arizona border. So it's not Salt Lake. It's very close to Las Vegas. So it's a smaller town. In a town like this, who has developed most of this city? It's rare to have large institutional foreign capital come and invest because most of those sources look for the big cities. So most of the people that develop a town like this are going to be your local developers, the good old boys club, people that have been here, their families are from here, they've made their money here. That's who's building up these local communities. And there's some benefits to doing that, but there are towns like this all over America. And most of the time, when you have the same group of people who are doing business in an area, there are opportunities that old guard is overlooking. An example of this would be in Waco. Waco, Texas is one of the markets where I invest in. Oftentimes, you'll have certain pockets of a town that just historically, for one reason or another, have been overlooked. Sometimes it might be because, 20 years ago there was a lot of crime issues in that area, or something happened in that area that just makes it a little bit less favorable. Well, things change over time. And so when you have a fresh set of eyes coming into a market like this, then we find opportunity. We find opportunity in areas that have been underserved and underdeveloped. We like to make sure that there's not still high crime, there's not still issues that historically have made it become a less desirable area, but there's plenty of areas that have since started to change, and just the local perception and local investors haven't caught on to that yet. So that's kind of my niche. I find secondary markets in America that can benefit from and create opportunities through a fresh set of eyes, have ample zoning opportunity because a lot of these secondary markets are underserved with housing. They tend to provide more zoning to permit what I want to do, and there's a lot less institutional large scale capital coming into these markets, and so I have less competition, while still being able to meet an unmet demand and make a good profit on these deals.
When you're in that situation, like how do you build a relationship with this? I see, well, I'm in a small town as well, and it just seems to me like the people who win in this development space here are people who live here, who know the city council people, who can get things through, you know, simple little things like that that can go a long way. It's sometimes who you know, not how much money you have, in essence, in some cases. And so I'm just curious, like, how do you navigate that when you're, you know, out of state and you're not a local, right?
Well, that comes from an understanding of zoning law, and we haven't really discussed that portion of my strategy yet, because you're right. You have that good old boys club, and they can get things done that I can't as an out of state or out of town developer. And that's one of the reasons why these smaller markets are primarily built by these local investors. And couple that with what I talked about earlier of historically you had to travel, and so most people want to invest where they live anyway. But over time, they've built those relationships because of how business has been done. But if you understand zoning law, then none of that matters. And that's another piece to what how I select my markets. And I'm not just going there because it's a secondary smaller town. And I don't go to two small towns. Usually, I want about 100 to 150,000 plus in population in the area. But I'm also identifying these cities that have ample zoning that permits what I want to do already. And a part of that strategy is most of these cities that need housing and that are underserved with housing, as many of these smaller cities in America are, adopt ordinance to permit multifamily in zones that aren't ordinarily multifamily zones. For example, you might have a city that says you have your MF 20 zone, which historically would mean multifamily 20 units per acre. Well, everybody in America knows that in the NF 20 zone, you can build multifamily 20 units per acre. So you get a lot of competition on those. But if that city says, my C2 zone, which is your commercial intensity to level zone, or however they describe that, but they also add as part of their permitted uses, multifamily is a use by right within that zoning. Well, now not everybody knows that I can build multifamily in the C2 zone. And so if I understand that, and if I've done the work to study and understand their zoning ordinance and which zones permit what I want to do, but other people may not realize that it allows me to do, now I can go and pursue a lot of properties with very little competition that's also pursuing those. And if I do have competition, it's somebody that's trying to buy it for a different use, which may have a different value assigned to that use. And so I have an edge on them to negotiate. So that's how I approach that. And if I'm only buying properties that already allow for what I want to do, I don't have to have a great relationship with the city staff. I don't have to have a relationship with council to be able to do that, because zoning is law. They cannot tell me no as long as I meet the standards that's listed spelled out in their zoning ordinance. That's not to say you don't still want to have a friendly relationship with them. We try our very best to do that, but we also understand zoning law, and we use that to our benefit. And so I'm not going and buying a 20-acre tract that's zoned agricultural and trying to rezone it for multifamily. I'm going to fail with this strategy of working remotely 9 times out of 10 on that.
How come?
But
Why do you think those towns, those C2 zones don't like why haven't the townships themselves thought of making it zoned for MF20? Like, is that just something that doesn't occur to them maybe, or because maybe the municipalities are just often average people who don't really think about things in terms of like, oh, well, we need more housing. Hey, if we zoned this for multifamily, we would solve our problem. Are they just not aware of that? I'll get to why I'm thinking of this in a second, but I'm curious
Yeah.
because I think it ties into a bigger scope of conversation.
Well, I don't know all the answers, but I have some thoughts on why that might be. The first is, for whatever reason, density. Density would be an example of you have a single family home versus an apartment complex. An apartment complex is a more dense use. You can fit more units in that same space. Density is usually looked less favorably by the residents of a city, and who controls and passes ordinance and zoning laws. It's publicly elected officials. So city council is eventually who adopts those and passes them on, and they want to be reelected. And so if they zone a bunch of families multifamily and it's close to single family residences, you're going to have all the people in that neighborhood be upset, and that's reduce their popularity and their ability to get reelected.
Makes sense
So
then.
that's just the
And
politics
yeah,
of the
those of
state.
us who live in a small town know that small town people are very involved in politics, local
Yes.
politics. It's not like a big city. It's very
Yeah.
different.
But
Yeah, that
if you
makes
have
sense.
commercially zoned property, it's oftentimes that's the most plentiful zoning in a city. That's zoning that will bring in uses that generate tax revenue. So
Okay.
commercial properties bring a lot of tax revenue. So some cities will be hesitant to just rezone that to multifamily because they want to keep the potential and strong possibility that it'll be developed for commercial and really benefit their city from a revenue standpoint. But they also recognize and understand that they need housing and dense housing, and that has a lot of benefits to their community. And so oftentimes they'll put that in as a use allowed in the commercial. So now they have a variety of, you might have an office and then a retail complex and then a higher density apartment complex. And that creates uses that are all complementary. You get walkability, you get traffic, and it's in areas that are further away from the lower density residential communities. And so
Okay.
you're less likely to get pushback from the local community.
That makes total sense. Okay, so here's what I'm hearing you say on a more global basis. Number one, you found a problem to solve, right? Places that need more housing and probably affordable housing, because I know a lot of the outskirts or suburbs, that's where people go to, I don't know, retire, I suppose you'd say. So they have a little bit more money that can drive up the residential housing market. It makes it harder for young people to live and work within that community. So then you need cheaper, more affordable housing, which usually comes in the form of multifamily. So you found a problem to solve. And then the second is you found who is it a win for and what parameters can you work within that area to serve everybody. Like it's a win-win for everybody. You've got a win-win for the municipalities, for the community, on all scales. Like it sounds like a really it's a good solution-oriented strategy, I think, is what I'm trying to say. And the same can be applied to any business. I mean, essentially, when you solve a problem, sometimes it can make sense to go directly to the person who needs it. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of times people want to buy, but they don't want to be sold to. And so when you can approach it just in an offshoot. So let me give a more clear example for the listening audience. We build systems and automations for coaches, course creators, online service professionals who want a digital product. Can we market to them directly? Yes. Is that market saturated? Yes. But what I find has very valuable is when we talk to bookkeepers and, accountants and people who really understand the mess that's going on in a business, they're very happy to refer us. Because we're solving a problem that's a win-win for multiple people. We get that trust factor, that relationship kind of passes on, and ultimately it helps everybody. And it's just coming at it from a little bit different angle. And so I just wanted to kind of verbalize that because I think that's something that a lot of times people overlook. We're so focused to go directly, to the avatar. We got to figure out who we're targeting, who we're going to do this for, et cetera. And not to say we shouldn't, we should definitely be optimized for that. But if you're going to set up a joint venture approach or a relationship building approach and kind of come at it just slightly off kilter, so to speak, you can often be even more successful in that vein. And that's what you've shown.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think one example that comes to mind is a property I built in Waco itself. It's a town just north of Waco called Lacey Lakeview. And this is an example of one of those areas that's just been overlooked. You have the Brazos River, which is just north of their downtown and Baylor University. And you have this whole section that's to the north there, with a lot of people and a lot of employment, especially that's up in that area. But over the last 20 years to 30 years, there's been no new multifamily complex built in this area. And so we came in and we built 214 units there right on the freeway. And we didn't really have to market. That was the most successful lease up that our property manager, which is a large one in the state of Texas, had ever had in the state of Texas during a time where everywhere else in the country, it was record low lease rates. And the reason why we were able to do that is not because we had a better marketing strategy. It's because we selected an area where people needed they needed housing, and we provided a good product, and we let them come to us because we knew that the need was going to be there for the right person.
That's lovely. I love that. Well, this has been a very, I think, helpful, informative episode. Where would people like, how do can people connect with you? What services would you, what are you looking for, and how can the audience serve you if it makes sense?
Sure. Yeah, from a high level standpoint, we're always looking to have people participate with us from an investment standpoint in our projects, but we're not really salesmen in that regard. We like to show value, and those that want to work with us will approach us. And so, those listening to this that might want to connect with me via LinkedIn. Paul Poteet is you'll be able to find me there with Surge Investment Group. You can also look us up at www.surgeig.com. But if you connect with me via LinkedIn, we do webinars about every 2 weeks, really centered towards education, teaching people how to approach investment in this space, some of the nuances that are involved in our business. I also publish regular articles to that same end. And so LinkedIn is the best place.
I love it. Well, thank you, Paul, for contributing. I'm really grateful for our conversation today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the great questions.